here you had no union movement, that's all. Germany, you had a union movement and you had a social democratic party. You had none here. I tell you, you have 2 million workers organized throughout the whole country. That's a very thin scatter. You had no union movement. You only had a genuine union movement arose only in 36, 37, 35 with the CIO. You had no union movement here, and so you didn't have that conflict. You had an aristocracy, a very thin layer of conscious trade unionists. You had no unions in the mass production industry. That wasn't true in Germany. Germany had powerful unions.
Could you contrast the role of the Communist Party at the time when they actually helped build the CIO and later when they signed or were contributors to those pledges?
That comes over here. Are you going to be here tomorrow? Well, I'll do it for you very briefly. Contrast when they're builders of the CIO. Well, see, here's what happened. From 1928 to 1933, they were in their so-called third period, their ultra-leftist period, when they were building revolutionary unions, split the union movement down the middle, all over the world. When Hitler came to power, they made a turn. Stalin made a turn. Made a turn to the right and signed a pact with Laval. Stalin-Laval Pact, which ushered in the People's Front, which was codified in the Seventh World Congress in 1935. Well, now if you'll see where this caught the CP, it caught just at the time when they were making the turn from the third period. That is, after Hitler came to power, they began to make the towards People's Frontism. You see, in 1934. They opposed the CIO. They were against the CIO. They were forced. They were sending their, when they decided to dissolve their revolutionary trade unions, they were sending them back into the American Federation of Labor, not in the CIO. And they were against the formation of the CIO. It wasn't in 35 after they had made the front. It was in 35, no, it was in 36 that Bridges was named CIO director on the Pacific Coast. That's when they made their switch, their turn, 35-36. That was after the Seventh World Congress. Now, they became supporters of the CIO in that period, but they became supporters of the right wing of the CIO. They were opposed to independent political action then, you see. They were for support of Roosevelt. They derailed the movement from its logical political course, which was inherent in the whole struggle, back into the channels of the Democratic Party. That's the role that they played in the CIO. 35, 36, 37, until 39. Then you had another turn with the Hitler-Stalin Pact, but we'll get into that tomorrow.
Wasn't that in 1933, the end of 1933, when the PUL disbanded?
No. It was after Hitler, again, remember when Hitler took power in Germany. It's somewhere in 33.
Hitler took power in 33.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember when in 33. After that time, it was in 34, I think, when they disbanded the TU.
Because I know in Chicago they disbanded at the end of 33 because I was part of the TU.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Maybe. I'm not certain of my dates, but it was in around there. It was after Hitler took power, they began to turn. I remember they began the turn in 34 because we were involved in a criminal syndicalist case in California then, where the CP was up on, a number of CP members were up on trial, and where the organizer of the CP in 34, in testifying in this court, repudiated their 33 line. So he had the line before the party officially made the turn. See, the party officially didn't make the turn until 35. That is a CP. Yes?
In 37, the economic downturn, the action got worse. There was the Memorial Day massacre, and the fascists got more active. Was there also a turn on the other board more interest in the Labor Party? Was there some of your polarization?
There were. There were, throughout this whole period, there were local movements. I remember in Michigan, there was the Michigan Commonwealth Federation. local movements which projected the idea that never assumed any kind of national stand, never had the support of any of the prominent leaders of the labor movement. What it did do, it was the beginning of a break between Lewis and Roosevelt. Now, Lewis, remember, he came out in 1940 and supported Wilkie, and said if Wilkie wasn't elected, he would resign from the CIO, and he did.
The role of the CP kept any effective National Labor Party movement from ever getting
over. Oh, yes, they were against the Labor Party, even in 1939. And then with the entry of the America into the war, of course, they became greater patriots than J.P. Morgan. You know, Browder, he shook hands with J.P. Morgan group, congratulated Morgan.
I was under the impression that throughout the whole period of the 30s, the CP ran candidates for national office.
Yeah, they did.
What did this mean?
Well, it meant, you see, like all turns, it meant that they had to... See, these were violent turns. The turn from, say, the third period to People's Front was a violent turn. And they couldn't just carry the whole party with them. They had to do it gradually, like they do with all their turns. So in 1936, they ran Browder on the slogan that, who was this fellow from Ohio? Landis. Their slogan was Landon. Alf Landon. The slogan was, Landon must be defeated at all costs. Well, you're running a candidate, and your slogan, Landon must be defeated at all costs. The logical conclusion is, if Landon must be defeated at all costs, then you vote for Roosevelt. You don't vote for Browder. So you say, well, does that mean you vote for Roosevelt? No, it only means that Landon is a reactionary, he must be defeated at all costs. Now, they don't come out, for example, they don't come out and endorse Kennedy. They don't do it that way, you see. They attack whoever the Republican is. They say the main danger is so-and-so, and that we've got to defeat the fascists, and so that's the way they operate, you see, in order to they've got to keep fooling the people who support them, who surround them. See? You see, they ran, for example, Browder ran in 1940 also, between 39 and 41. But that was the period of the Stalin-Hitler Pact, you see. That's when Roosevelt was condemned as a warmonger, where the main enemies became Chamberlain and who was the French premier at the time. When their slogan then was that Hitler wanted peace and we ought to have peace. So he ran in 1940.
Was there any significance to that period?
I didn't get that. Significance to what? Well, as I say, the radicals had youth organizations. The CP had the biggest youth organization, the Young Communist League. The SP had the YPSLs, the Young People's Socialist League. The Trotskyists had the Spartacus, Young Spartacus. And they played a very significant role, both in the CIO. Many of them, especially the CP, who became a real power in the CIO, became organizers and leaders of their unions. And some of them today are still, very few of them, some of them today are still leaders of the unions. You had a big radicalization on the campus. And also you had a big right wing. I remember many of the strike breakers were students too. So you have this struggle taking place on the campus. In the maritime strike, for example, Johnson, General Johnson, they called him General Iron Pants Johnson. Don't ask me why, I don't know. He was supposed to be a tough guy. He came out. He was sent out to the San Francisco from Washington by Roosevelt. And he recruited, he went out on the University of California campus and recruited students as strike breakers to break the longshore strike in San Francisco. And he recruited quite a sizable number. The reason they weren't able to break the strike then was not only the militancy of the longshoremen and teamsters, but of the longshoremen and seamen, but the support of the teamsters, you see. They had enough people to work the ships, to do the longshore work, but they couldn't move the cargo off the docks because the teamsters respected the picket line. And so they had to declare an embargo. The docks became just overwhelmed with cargo, and they couldn't move any, so the ships had to lay out in the harbor, and they couldn't unload. It was the Teamsters Union that played a decisive role, and that was after the San Francisco General Strike, when they murdered two longshoremen. The cops murdered two longshoremen, and the labor movement in San Francisco declared a general strike. And it was after that that the Teamsters came out and refused to move any cargo off of the docks. No. No. Now, shall we discuss that here or here? Well, we'll discuss it here as long as you bring it up. We didn't come out for a labor party until 1938 at the founding convention of the Socialist Workers' Party. In 1936, when we entered the Socialist Party in 1936, many people in the Socialist Party were for advocating the formation of the Labor Party. We were opposed to it then. Now, the basis of our opposition was that the question had not been decided as to what form the radicalization of the American working class would take, what political form it would take, whether it would take the form of the organization into a political party of a reformist type based upon the example in, say, Great Britain or the social democratic parties in Europe, or whether, because of the tremendous crisis, they would skip that stage and be embraced within the confines of a revolutionary political party. He says, history has not yet answered that question. If, for example, say it's an iffy example. If Hoover had been reelected and had continued his policy of 1932, there would have been a revolutionary situation in this country, which would have exploded in revolutionary form. It wouldn't have taken the form of organization into the trade unions, which was opened up and made possible by the sympathetic attitude taken by the Roosevelt administration towards trade union organization. It would have taken a political form, and in all probability a revolutionary political form, not a reformist labor party form. But we said when the CIO had emerged, when a genuine trade union movement for the first time in history had emerged, embracing the decisive section of the American working class, then we said that any political development would of necessity take place through the existing organization of the workers. It wouldn't be outside of their organization. It would be through the trade union movement, you see, through the CIO. We said that would be the most likely course of development, and therefore we have to advocate a labor party development based upon the trade unions. That is, the only the genuine trade union movement had been formed in the course of the struggle. Now, the question now arises, is the labor party form the inevitable form of political development. We don't know. We say it's the most likely variant. But if the labor fakers today succeed in heading off any independent political development of the working class move, and if the Negro people continue in their march towards revolutionary radicalization, it's altogether possible that there will not be a reformist labor party, but a revolutionary labor party. You got to view the thing dialectically. You can't say this is a blueprint, it's got to develop in this part. History will decide again. But because we feel the most likely variant will be that so long as the union still exists 18 million strong, that if the working class begins to move and becomes radicalized, they will move through their organizations and institutions, the most likely variant would be the Labor Party. But that would not be true 10 years from now. As I will go in, I'll show you in my next lecture on the trade union development what's happening to the union development. That the decisive section of the working class will be outside of the unions, unless there's a very radical change in the union leadership and policy. As I say, these developments must be viewed. That's why I try to do here is to show you more tomorrow how the development of the political party took place in the context of the movement of the working class. That's the only way I think you can really understand it.
Most of the specific tactics that we hear about, like fill the jail movement to lead as the sit-in.
Like the what?
Like fill the jail movement in Toledo. Like the sit-down, sit-ins, the twin stuff, like the flying squadron, something like that. Were those tactics that were devised and hadn't been seen before, were usually...
Yes, those arose right out of the mass movement itself. Just like out of the Negro movement today, you see they develop tactics out of their own experience. The sit-down, the flying squad, the women's auxiliaries all arose out of the experience of the workers themselves. See, the workers have seen so many strikes broken on the picket line through the injunction, through the use of cops, through the use of the National Guard and of federal troops, that when they struck, say, against a corporation like General Motors, you see. Now, how are you going to win such a strike? They decided we'll sit down inside the plant instead of picketing on the outside. Then the women's auxiliaries, they had to develop a kitchen to feed the workers inside the plants. They raised the food. They came down and went through the, smashed through the cops trying to prevent them from getting to the men that were in the plants. And then the flying squads were developed in order, at any trouble spot, to be able to get flexibility. So they would send, say, squads of pickets to a plant that in which the scabs were trying to break through the picket line. And many other arose out of the experience of the workers in the struggle. And that's what we'll see again. No tactical prescription you're going to give this mass movement of any kind. It develops its own tactics.
Was the tactic of nonviolence
they required? No. It was not very popular. It would have no reality then, because every picket line had to be defended against scabs, in order to win the strike. And scabs, of course, were supported by cops, or by the National Guard, or by the company thugs. So actually, the pickets were defending themselves. In that sense, they were nonviolent. But they defended themselves sometimes rather violently. There was no such philosophy of nonviolence. Now, of course, you have a different situation, say, in the civil rights struggle today, where, for example, in the South, where the Negroes are a very small minority and they're up against the whole power of the state,
the state power in its police force, in its overwhelming white population, in its National Guard, its control of the sheriffs, and so forth and so on, that this becomes an effective tactic, you see. Because it's a tactical question for us. And even there, as I say, it's not a principle. It's an effective tactic, and we don't condemn anybody for utilizing this tactic. They feel that this is the method in which they can best protect themselves against this overwhelming power which they confront. Under different circumstances, they will act differently.
Would you describe the activities of the settlements during the period of the settlement?
Well, let's wait until tomorrow for that.
In the view of this, pending decision on the railroad workers threatening strike and threatening compulsory arbitration and so forth, Walter Lippmann wrote recently regarding the so-called theory of collective bargaining and how the patterns are shaping up with regard to treating this possible strike or national industry tend to become a pattern. There were too many industries left. Attention on the so-called theory of collective bargaining that he's referring to, as if it's some sort of social contract entered into. And I wonder what comments you would have about all the paraphernalia, all the apparatus that the government has set up from the beginning of the anarchy now until the present to deal with.
Well, we'll get into that in the next talk. You see, we get into that in the post-war period. The real change in the relationship of forces on a national scale, the role of collective bargaining as it developed out of the war and as it exists today.
Well, you would date that to the war rather than.
Oh yes, that begins with the period of 1947 with Taft-Hartley. See, in this period, don't forget that all of the collaboration was voluntary. There was no compulsion on the unions, except compulsion of the influence, say, that a Roosevelt had. Under the Wagner Act and the National Labor Relations Board, the unions had all kinds of rights, see. They had to enforce them with their power. But once the unions were organized, once the unions broke through the initial resistance and began organizing, especially with the rise of the CIO, then there was a tremendous accretion of union membership through the device of the National Labor Relations Board elections, you see. And many, many unions, probably the majority of unions today, came into existence not through struggles on the picket line, like the UAW and the steel workers and the maritime workers, but through the instrumentality of the National Labor Relations Board elections, you see. Well, a change took place in 1947 with the enactment of Taft-Hartley, which altered the relationship of forces. And with 1946, as we'll when we go into the next period, when the employers tried to smash the unions like they did after the First World War and failed, then they had to resort to the government legislation to intervene on behalf of the employer. And the intervention has been all on that side since, you see. Up to this point, the intervention has been on the side of favoring the unions in the organization of the unemployed and in carrying on their struggle. Union membership, for example, doubled from 1941 to 1945, during the period of the war. Well, of course, it doubled because there was a tremendous expansion of industry, wartime industry, and a tremendous influx into the unions. And because they had an agreement with the government, the so-called maintenance of membership clause, for which they gave up the right to strike. but which meant that tremendous numbers of workers came into the unions. The biggest accretion of union membership came during the period of the war. And the peak of the union strength was in the period of the post-war period. The decline began with Taft-Hartley in 1947, and that's the period you're talking about. We'll discuss that in the next... Someone here had up their hand up? Betsy?
I decided not to ask it.
You would want to sit out further and ask?
You didn't go into too much detail on the sit downs in auto and the big, this rising CIO that you have there. I wondered what role did the radicals play in that?
Oh, well, as I say, the radicals played a very important role throughout this whole period. Both the rank and file radicals, especially the rank and file radicals. You see, when the CIO came along, for example, there was no problem organizing workers. The problem was signing them up. There were sit-downs. It wasn't only sit-downs in auto. The girls in the 5 and 10 cent store were sitting down. They were sitting down all over the goddamn place, and they were clamoring for CIO organizers to sign them up. You know, that was what organizing was in those days. It was a tremendous spontaneity. That's right. I'm not exaggerating. I'm not joking. There was a tremendous spontaneous upsurge that affected all sections of the working class. And Lewis very consciously entered into collaboration with the Communist Party because they were the ones who could provide him with people who had some trade union consciousness. You know, they had all of their revolutionary trade unionists, they had their unemployed people, they had their students. That was one of the reasons that the CP got a foothold in the CIO. And at one time almost took over the entire organization. They very consciously enlisted the support of radicals at that time, because radicals they knew could do the job for them. See, that changed only after 1946, after the Cold War, is when they began, in a small part in here, in the Hitler Sound Pact, but more especially after the Cold War, when they began to take out after the radicals.
Did the CIO make any serious attempt to organize itself in the 1930s? And if it did, what did they run? I know they didn't have breaks on a whole lot of industries.
I don't quite understand your question.
Did the CIO try any organized itself in itself? During 1936-37?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, they organized, for example, they organized auto. They organized rubber.
Oh, Tom, you didn't hear it. In the South.
Oh, South, no. No. You see, up until about the Second World War, the South was largely an agricultural. The industrialization of the South really began with the Second World War. The urban population in the South was very small. So far as I know, they really made no attempt. No, because they had their hands full, you see. See, what happened was, when the CIO split, you see, then they were involved not only in an attempt to organize the unorganized, but in a war with the AFL, you see. Then the AFL, during that period, up until their fusion, almost in 1955, and especially in that period, they began organizing on the employers on the basis of insurance against the CIO. You see, they would organize them as being the more patriotic union. See, CIO became stigmatized as the red union, communist union. And the AFL would offer these sweetheart contracts. They would sign up an employer with a union contract even before they even had an election. And they had this internecine warfare going on all the time. And so they had their hands full. And there was nothing much in the South for them to organize except extensions of plants that had their headquarters in the North, like some steel plants, like cities like Birmingham, some textile plants. But there was very little in the South, very little of an industrial character in the South. That came later. Well, see, the main split was between the craft unions, especially the building trades, metal trades unions. And there the rank and file has very little to say, less today probably than ever before, and they weren't very much concerned. They weren't concerned with industrial organization. Craft form of organization fitted their particular industry, their particular areas. So there was not, if my memory serves me, there was not any great struggles in which the rank and file of the union became involved. There were instances, you see, where unions came over to the CIO after the all the groundwork had been laid and the organization had been more or less established. And there were unions who originally participated in the formation of the CIO who went back to the AFL. Dubinsky, for example, one of the founders, the International Ladies Garment Workers, and Howard of the ITU. They went back to the American Federation of Labor.
I couldn't give a specific example of how the rank and file were involved.
Except in those areas where they were.
The AFL had the printers union for a period of years. Then in 36, at a national convention, it was agreed that the CIO newspaper guild would organize the all the other
Thank you.
strikes took place, say, within unions, like I said the remark before, the federal unions. Say the automobile workers were first organized in an AFL federal union. And they were very much dissatisfied. And they'd gone through a number of struggles, and all of these struggles were sabotaged by the leadership that was appointed. And so when they had got the opportunity to vote to affiliate with the CIO, they just went in. And then, as I said before, a lot of company unions voted to affiliate with the CIO. It was a relatively simple matter then to ask for a National Labor Relations Board election, and if you got a majority, then you joined the union of your choice. Not like it is today. So far as I know, no real attempt to organize office workers, except in isolated instances. See, at that period, 1936, the office workers didn't loom so very, they're not a very important part of the labor force, or so those so-called white-collar workers, I should say, as today. Today it's a real problem for the organized labor movement. Than it was. And many unions, many industrial unions, took the office workers along with the others, you see. Many times where they met too much resistance on the part of the employer, why they just didn't bother, especially when there was a small number involved.
Do you think this will be more of a perspective now?
What's that?
In the future.
Organized office worker?
Yeah.
Well, it's their perspective, but I don't think that they're going to get very far. The union leaders, I imagine you say, of the union leaders?
No, I mean, is it the next attempt to draw more people into the...
Well, no, I don't think so. I don't think so, not in any large... I have a different perspective, you see. They say we're getting ahead of ourselves all the time. My perspective, for example, my prognosis, rather, than not my perspective, is that the next upsurge will not see a repetition of what we had in the 30s. That is just not another accretion of a few more 100,000 workers or even a few million more. That won't make any qualitative difference whatsoever. It'll make no difference whatsoever. That's not the problem for the American working class. That's my prognosis, but we'll go into that later. Well, if you realize the character of the upsurge that took place, it was a spontaneous movement that infected all sections of the working class. You see, if you've ever participated in a revolution, or when you will, you'll understand what I'm talking about. Or do you hear people who talk about Cuba and what happened to the people of Cuba who were ciphers, didn't count for anything during the period prior to Castro regime. The company unions were really in the front. I belonged to one of them. I worked for the Western Electorate at Hawthorne here and Cicero. And we had a company union there was called the Hawthorne Club. It was an affront to your intelligence. So at noon they would have an orchestra out there playing music for us, and then you could buy things wholesale, socks and underwear and stuff like that. And then in the summer they'd have a picnic for us, and occasionally we'd all gather together, and one of the supervisors would give us a pep talk, you see, about how the company and the employers and how much they had at stake, both working for each other and with each other and so forth and so on. Well, workers didn't go, you know, it was so goddamn. For example, I worked there for 3 years, I think, 2 or 3 years, and during the war, they did what many other companies did. Instead of raising your base pay, they gave you your base pay plus what they called a war rate. I remember my base pay was $21 plus a $2 war rate, which was $23. Well, by 1921, the war was over. It had been over for 3 years. So they said, well, now, obviously, the war is over. There's no longer any justification for a war rate. So they said, well, we're not going to cut your base pay. All we're going to do is eliminate the war rate, you see. Well, that's when we parted company. So, I mean, that was the kind of outfits they had, you see. The workers considered them a joke. You had to belong to them because you had to do it in order to hold your job. You had no independence. You had to listen. I remember twice a day, one of the proposals that they made at one meeting was that one of these, Taylor, is it the expert, efficiency expert?
Yeah.
Taylor, he had discovered that you get more efficiency out of your employees if you have a break twice a day. Well, it wasn't a coffee break, it was an exercise break. In the middle of winter, they open up all the goddamn windows, and then some jerk would stand up on top of the table, and he would give exercises like this for about 5 minutes, and we would all have to stand there going through these exercises in order to put out more work for the company. Well, unions that gave you benefits like that weren't very attractive, you see. And so when an opportunity came along, especially a tremendous movement like this, it was a very simple matter, you see. The organization structure was set up. It was an easy matter to, at one of these meetings, for somebody to make a motion that we have a labor board election, you see, or we support the CIO. And all that was necessary was sign up cards, you know, you would sign cards, call an organizer, CIO organizer down, he'd distribute a bunch of cards, he'd get signatures on them, he'd go before the employers, he said, here, we represent a majority of your employees, we want an election, or a contract. If you don't believe we have a majority, we demand an election. You'd have an election and they would vote for the CIO. No, don't you see what happened during the war? I was going to see that we constantly get ahead of ourselves. I think we can't help it. See, during the war, the union leaders surrendered the right to strike. They said, well, we've given up what is our most important weapon in organizing the unorganized. For that, we want something in exchange. And so the government said, all right. They agreed that in exchange, they would get what they call a maintenance of membership clause in the union contract. That is, that when you went to work for an employer who was under union contract, you would have to, so long as you remained an employee, you would have to join the union. And your dues would be checked off. You'd have the check. So actually the organization was automatic. So as the workers, say, swarmed into these plants, they automatically became members of the union by virtue of the maintenance of membership clause. And the checkoff. No, it has no derogatory effect as aspect so far as the workers are concerned. You can criticize the union leaders for surrendering the right to strike, for entering into collaboration, into the War Labor Board. They agreed to freeze wages, for example, in addition to surrendering the war right to strike, on the promise that prices would be frozen also, which they weren't. But you can't blame workers who, many of whom were unemployed, who went to work and found themselves in the union. Did you want to interrupt me, Betsy? You can, you know.
No, I just got my intended quote, so that...
Oh, you didn't want to interrupt me, you just want to shut me up. Okay, if that's what you think, put it to the audience.
We've got three more nights.